Hello, everybody, and welcome to the GMS Magazine channel. I am Paco Garcia, your host, and this is the RPG Interview Room, the show in which I am lucky enough to get together with some of the best people in the world of role-playing games and ask them a ton of questions. For transparency's sake, I have to tell you that this is the second time that this interview takes place. I was lucky enough to get Seng Fung Ling to actually come to the show a few weeks ago, and we had a problem with the audio. For some reason, it just did not save onto my computer. So we just had an awful lot of people doing this. No audio whatsoever. Sam was very kind and gracious to come back, and I managed to recover the interview, which I am so pleased about, because we went into all sorts of topics from joint design, you know, when you collaborate with other people, differences between board game design and role-playing game design, and also what it is like to bring your experience as an immigrant and son of immigrants to your games, to portray that experience. And I can tell you, I could have spent hours and hours and hours talking to Seng about it, because yeah, he's good. I'm not kidding. He's good. So I am not going to go any further, and I am just going to let the interview commence. I will talk to you later. Seng, thank you very much indeed for being with me today again. I will have already told people, but for transparency, this is the second time that I have you in the show, but the first time that people are going to see you, because my computer kind of screwed me over and didn't get your side of the things, which was a truly important stuff. So we're kind of repeating this interview. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing fine. Things are okay. Good.
Good. Excellent. Right. Okay. I would normally ask the five usual questions, but I know. Okay. Well, I'm going to ask you five different questions this time.
Sure.
And see what happens. Okay. There are other sodas out there. Okay, listeners. But Pepsi or Coca-Cola?
Oh, Coca-Cola. I don't like either, to be honest.
Okay, fair enough.
Although I did drink a Coke today. I don't normally drink Coke, but my wife loves Coke. And so there's always Coke in the house. And so I was driving to work and I thought, oh, I should drink something. I was teaching, so talking with a mask on is really dehydrating. Not that caffeine actually helps hydrate your vocal cords, but anyway, yeah, she likes Coke. And so that is default what I guess I like.
Okay.
But I actually don't like colas at all.
Okay, no, I don't blame you. Marshmallows or gummy bears?
Gummy bears, probably. Okay. I think marshmallows are like, it's like edible oil, so.
Okay, that is fair enough indeed. Brownies or cheesecake?
Oh, that's a good one. So I only like one very specific cheesecake made by a very specific person.
Okay.
Because I find cheesecake really heavy, and I'm not a dessert person. But my friend, Christine, she's a chef, and so she makes this very, very specific lime cheesecake that is very light that I really like, because I like lime as well, so... There you go. That's my favorite cheesecake.
Okay.
Christina's cheesecake.
If you want a light cheesecake, Japanese cheesecake is perfect.
Oh, I know. I it's okay.
Absolutely adore that. Okay. Let's go into slightly harder questions.
Okay, cool.
Euros or Ameritrash?
That's a really good question. So I think when I first started getting into gaming, it was definitely just my nature of where I live. It was Ameritrash or Amerithrash or whatever people want to call it. I'm fine with calling it whatever because I'm Canadian. Ha ha. So it doesn't bother me what we call it. And then definitely played more Euro style gaming in the 90s. But before that was all like American. And then lately, I guess I'm more into hybrid, I think, kind of in between, mm-hmm. where there's story, but there's still like distinct strategy that isn't necessarily based on a roll of a die, but that there is like emotional swings and arcs and narrative involved as well. So I don't mind a little bit of variability. I also don't mind a little bit of control. I'm not all one way or another. Like I like Stefan Feld games just fine. They're like spreadsheets that you play, and that's cool. But I also enjoy big narrative games. I think for me, I would much rather play a role-playing game if that was the case anyway. Mm-hmm. I'd much rather create that story myself than play it in a board game style.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, and last but not least, now this is a very easy question for me, but not for everybody. Dragons or unicorns?
Oh, dragons.
Okay, good. Thank goodness.
Dragons, 100%. Yes. They're much cooler. I mean, don't get me wrong, unicorns are okay, but I'm definitely a dragon person.
I just like dragons. So, okay, right. Let's start with this. You have designed an awful lot of board games. You've had an insanely prolific career. How many board games have you designed or co-designed? Like 20 or 25 already?
I think there's 4 pages on BGG.
Exactly. I lost.
But that includes all the expansions and stuff too. So probably in total over 25 for sure.
Which is a lot. I mean, you have to be doing this very, very often. And yet, you don't do this full time at this moment, not just yet. Is it really that hard to make a living out of board games?
Yeah, it is, because I might design, 4, 5, 6 games a year, but only 2 of them get published every year. Mm-hmm. And because I tend to co-design, because I like co-designing, we split the profits. And so it's definitely not enough to say, hey, you should go do this full time. As you know, I'm a professor, so I make a good salary. And currently I have 2 children that are under 18. So in preparation for their education and college and things like that, I can't make the switch in good faith yet. Okay. I would like to. I mean, I'm working on it. I'm planning on it. Jay and I are doing a bunch of other stuff that will hopefully lead to that, mm-hmm. where we'll have residual income that we don't have to actually do anything for or much. Or we can pay people to do that with the amount of income that comes off of it. So we do have other tracks and plans of how we're doing things. I think, there are only very few designers that are purely doing design as freelancers. It's very rare in the industry, and it comes off of having like 1 or 2, if you're lucky to get 2, evergreen games that continuously sell, and then doing brand extension off of that. So like Matt Leacock is somebody who can do that. But I think I don't know if you've talked to Matt Leacock. Have you talked to Matt?
I know Matt. He's a good friend.
So if you've talked to Matt, that it wasn't until like pandemic had been like, okay, I guess I can do that now. And then after that happened, then we got to see Iberia and we got to see Cthulhu and things like that. But it wasn't until then that Matt could have really made the switch, until pandemic was like certified, this is going to continue forever type stuff. It's the nature of the beast is really that I think most people who are doing work full-time freelance in the industry are kind of cobbling together an existence from various things, right? So I know that if I was to do it, chances are I'd be doing development as well as design as well as writing. So like I write for a lot of RPGs, and I do development work for a lot of companies. And then I'd be doing my own designs as well. So it'd probably be like, roughly a third to make sure that there is constant cash flow. Because again, with royalties, you get paid usually quarterly, mm-hmm. at the best, right? So there are better ways of generating money on a regular basis than royalties. Royalties are just like the long tail. But for a short-term thing, like a writing gig that's paying, you know, 10 cents a word and you write, you know, a couple thousand words, good. There you got, you know, $300 this week, $300 next week. If you can do that, right? You have to find enough contracts to be able to do that kind of stuff though. So, and that's the other thing. So it's really interesting that there are people out there who can be like full-time game media, mm-hmm. right? They can be like doing, because there's so many games to talk about. There's so many people to interview. And if you have a channel that people want to watch, you can raise your profile much easier than a designer can, because designers are like lucky, like literally lucky if they get a game published a year, right?
That's very true.
Because it takes a lot of time to make a game. Like a game, if you played, Dolores of Eldervale, Luke Laurie was just saying it took him like 3 years from start to the day that he got it in his hands. 3 years to get that, right?
That's incredible.
And in that time, he's actually spending money to, you know, pitch it and take it to conventions and refine it and all that kind of stuff. And it probably wasn't until the Kickstarter had finished and things started rolling that he actually probably got paid for that, right? So it's a hard existence, to be honest, in terms of design. I mean, it's not a oh, woe is me story, but it's like there's a reason why 99% of us, even though we're published many, many times, keep our day jobs, because it's not feasible financially, mm-hmm. especially in certain economies.
So it's quite
like COVID.
I mean, I find it quite interesting, because being a media person myself, many times when I talk to fans and I talk to people, especially the, you know, what I like to call the lay player, just the guys or the people who buy games and play them and mm-hmm. Buy a lot of games, they tend to believe that there is a lot of money to be made for the designers, because games cost, in brackets, a lot of money, which is, it's a completely different conversation.
I mean,
they do not cost a lot of money at all.
No, not in terms of value per play, if you play it many times. But I don't think lay people understand the economy of games. So games are roughly, I can tell you the math right now. So you take the landed cost, which is manufacturing plus shipping, multiply that by about anywhere from 5 to 8 times, and that's your MSRP. And then it gets discounted and cut and sliced at every level, depending on your, so you're the publisher, you pay the manufacturer, and then you have to get it to distribution. Distribution gets it to the friendly local game store. Friendly local game store sells it to you. And at every stage, people are making a margin. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, it's usually about a 3-to-1 ratio, 4-to-1 ratio for what the publisher makes and what the designer makes per copy. And the publishers have output a whole bunch of money. So if I make $1.20 on like a $25 game, around $25 to $50 game, you can make, you know, around $2. That publisher's only making like $8. Mm-hmm. Right. So the rest of the money is actually shipping. Shipping is huge. It's moving this thing around from place to place. And so distribution buys it for a certain amount, sells it to the store for a certain amount, and they sell it to you for a certain amount. And at every stage, people are taking their little chunk of that. And so no, unless you are selling like tens of thousands of copies mm-hmm. on a regular basis, you are not making much money. Like we've had games that have only made like $4,000 in total, and you split it by two people, and I've only made $2,000 in total. That's not a lot of money. But we've also made games that are making like, you know, $10,000 on the regular, mm-hmm. but that's in a year. You know, that's not enough to sustain a person. That's not on a monthly basis, or even on a quarterly basis, that's like in a year. So most people, unless they make like that one big hit or are employed by the publisher on a permanent basis, need to have multiple titles, right? So those 24 odd titles that I have, you know, I wouldn't say there's not 25 active at once. It's more like 3 or 4, active at once. And a lot of them are out of print or have got, or like, you know, very low sales because it's at the end of the life of that game. And the publishers are thinking, you know, should I republish that or not? So there's all these questions, and you're really left up to the whim of the publishers as a designer, which is why, you know, the trend now, especially with Kickstarter, is for designers to run their own publishing imprint because they get to take all the money, but they also have to do all the work, right? So that's why a lot of people who are designers, especially people who are later in life, who might have kids, can't actually make that jump to become a publisher because, well, or to be a full-time designer because they don't have the, there's no padding there. Now, if they wanted to start a company and become the publisher, the problem with that is now you're not really a designer anymore. You're actually a publisher. Mm-hmm. And you know how I said there's like four times the money goes to the publisher than the designer? There's also like four, maybe even more times the work that goes. It becomes a full-time job. And so that's the other thing. If you want to be a publisher, great, go be a publisher. Just recognize that you probably won't be designing as much as you want.
And also, the thing that I found is an awful lot of people who go into, you know, Kickstarter to publish their own game, and then they realize that they actually don't like publishing that much. They just want to design cool games and not do all this hard work.
Well, so it's not necessarily hard work, but it's not easy work either. And it's a different mindset. It's like logistics and planning and, you know, timelines and sticking to these things. And you'll find that a lot of game designers are actually artists, like they're the artist or the illustrator, or the graphic designer, first and foremost. And they just said, oh, I can also make games. Whereas publishers, a lot of publishers are none of those things. Mm-hmm. Like if you asked, like, you know, Stephen Bonacore to make a game, he'd be like, what? I can't make a game, but I can publish them. Yeah, I like playing them. I like publishing them. I have a good eye for them. I can, you know, project manage, but I'm not a designer. That's why he doesn't design. That's why
he's very good.
Or did. He did. He did. He sold out. He sold out. I make it sound like it's bad. He's retired.
Yes.
Yes.
And good on him. He's worked very hard.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So good on him.
No, great on him. Yeah. We'll get together and play games as much as possible now.
Good.
But yeah, the idea that designers are making lots of money is kind of a fallacy for 99.999% of designers. And even those that are making a lot of money, say like Isaac Childress with Gloomhaven, it's because he publishes it, right? I bet you if there was another publisher who made that game, he A, wouldn't be making that amount of money, and B, it wouldn't have actually been successful. It was this really weird, rare shot in the dark that just happened to hit, not only because it's a good game,
yes,
but because of the delivery model and the price point that he set it at the beginning. And like, you'll notice that every iteration of it, the price creeps up, right? Mm-hmm. Because it was definitely not priced intelligently. I mean, and he's a super smart guy, right? I think he has his PhD in physics, but he's not stupid at all. It just was priced at a point where like most publishers could not have legitimately priced it at that. But because he's the designer of it, he can cut himself out, right? Mm-hmm. So instead of five parts, he only needs four parts of money, right? It's an interesting way of doing it.
Yes.
Right. But then as it became more popular and he realized that, oh, shipping a 22-pound box around the world is easy. I mean, that's a big deal. Like a lot of Kickstarter companies, if they make enough, but not enough, do you know what I mean? Like they fund, but they don't fund like exorbitantly, but even sometimes even more if they do, they can make the game, but they don't have the funds to ship it.
That's happened many, many times. People go into trouble for that.
Shipping is the single most difficult thing because you can't predict it and you have no control over it. And it has to happen, right? True. It's not like something you can't not ship it.
Well, you can, but then that's kind
well,
of
well, yeah, you know what I mean.
Ethical and legal and all sorts of things. But
so there you go.
Okay, you do. However, you've mentioned how you like co-designing games. Mm-hmm. Why is that? What is it that co-designing ads to the formula for you?
Well, I mean, so I'm, you know, best friends with my co-designer, Jay. And we actually started this to not make games. We started this to actually be in touch with each other. He moved across the country about 3,000 kilometers away to Vancouver when I was still in Hamilton. And yeah, it was our way of staying in touch with each other. You know how some people, you know, play sports together. We make games together. Okay. And it just happened to become a business proposition in the end. It's like, oh, these are actually kind of good. I wonder if anybody else would like these. So it started that way, as a way to maintain our friendship over distance. And why I like the whole idea of co-designing is because I've recognized in my older age, when I was younger, I didn't think this way, by the way. I thought I was, you know, super smart and could make anything by myself. And I realized as I get older that I couldn't do it all, that I was merely okay at most things, really, really good at a few things and amazing at like one thing. And so I realized that, you know, working with complementary people, people who don't have the exact same skill set but can complement in some way or can make you better, mm-hmm. you know, can bring out the best in you, that's what's really enthralling to me about co-design, is that kind of back and forth, these ideas that you bounce off and you, it's like, this idea is so good. Oh, you're amazing. And oh, no, you're amazing. And that kind of positive energy that happens is really great. I find that because I am a very cerebral person, like I think a lot about games and I design them in my head, that co-design forces me to articulate my thought process to another person. And if I can't do that, then it wasn't a good game in the first place. Okay. So it forces me to actually get something, you know, in words and then put it on the table and forces me to do that. And before, I was the kind of person who would just figure it all out in my head and say, oh, it's good enough. And then almost never get to the making it point. But now, because I work with co-designers, they're like, I don't understand, or I don't think it's going to work like you think it's going to work. It usually does. But still, we have to put it on paper to prove mm-hmm. that it works. And that's really important because you actually don't have a game until it's on the table and okay. it's something that somebody else can play. So I know there's a lot of argument on the internet, you know, if you're a game designer or not, you know, have you designed a game? Then you're a game designer. I think is true. Yeah. I would say that's true, but not if you haven't put it on the table in a form that other people can play, right? Mm-hmm. If it's all in your head, you're still designer.
No, then you're just a dream and imagination person. But
yeah,
no,
I mean,
no, I agree.
And theory crafting is fine, but let's put it to the test to actually call you a game designer. Right. That's kind of my limit. Mm-hmm. I think the only other useful thing to say is if you're published or not, mm-hmm. and there might be some usefulness in self-published versus other published. Mm-hmm. But in general, if you made a game, you're a game designer. Welcome to the club.
Yes.
But it has to be something that people can play.
No, definitely. It has to be something material. I mean, I am very, very big on the, if you write, you're a writer. If you're a designer, if you design, you're a designer. But having it in your head is just not good enough. I need to see the writing.
There's got to be some you know, barrier.
Yes.
To entry, and it's not about gatekeeping. It's about
about proving that you actually do exactly, and that you
you
do what you say you can do. Otherwise, it's a bit, you know, I can be a neuropsychologist. Can I do neuropsychology? No. But hey, who would know if I don't do it? So right. Yeah, the proof of the test is in the pudding or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, the proof of the eating is in the pudding.
Yeah, exactly. I knew there was a food somewhere. Okay. Now, you've also, which we're going to go into pretty much right away, because it segues into your cooperating with people and also writing role-playing games.
Yeah.
Now, this could have been one of the initial questions, but I wanted to ask you in the middle of the podcast, if you had to choose between one for the rest of your life, which one would you go for, designing board games or designing role-playing games?
Honestly, for the rest of my life, it would be role-playing games.
Okay.
Yeah, and I mean, I cut my teeth in board games, but I started gaming as a role player. as a little wee kid playing with, you know, adults in the basement of a university in Northern Ontario in Canada, because my mom ran out of things for me to do. How is that precocious 6-year old? It was funny. So my friend asked me today, because she was looking for freelancers for something. She goes, what kind of games do you like? And what are your rates? And I said, because she knows. And I said, it's different for development or design or writing. And she goes, okay, give me the rates. And I gave her the rates. And then she said, what kind of project do you really like to work on? I said, I really like, designing games that are, provide interesting experiences and make you think. But also allow you to tell a story or tell a good story, or the game itself tells a good story. And I find that role-playing games do that immensely well. I find board games are procedural and kind of by the book. And I think, board games allow you to play the game, but role-playing games allow you to explore the game a little bit better. Mm-hmm. My feelings about it. I also think role-playing games are better teaching tools because they have built-in almost standardized phases of like debriefing that nobody in a board game ever debriefs. Why would you? So how do you feel about, playing Puerto Rico? I don't know. I scored 83 points. Done, right? Whereas a role-playing game, it's like, hey, tell me, who do you think did an awesome job of, playing their character today? Oh, this person, and they did this, and it was wonderful, right? I also think that role-playing games build memories better because of the narratology behind it. And they tend to be things that I don't disengage from. I do disengage from board games while they're being played. Because if somebody's taking a long time, I just might go, look at my phone or something. But typically in a role-playing game, unless the party's split, I'm like in there listening and I want to hear what you have to say. I want to hear you do cool things. I want to see what my character is going to do after you do your cool thing. But I got to know what you're doing to do that. Whereas a lot of board games, I already mentioned Stefan Feld. So a lot of like those types of Euros are, the derogatory term would be multiplayer solitaire, yes, where it doesn't really matter what you do on your turn because it doesn't affect me that much, except usually in terms of, you took something that I might have wanted. But until you take it, it doesn't bother me at all. And even if you do take it, it's just like, okay, I guess it's not there. I got to change my decision plan now. So I enjoy some of those games because I like puzzles a lot. But I like telling stories more than I like puzzles. So I guess that's where that lies. I would much rather build a world and do that with people than roll some dice and just see what the effect is. So I'm traditional role-playing games really aren't for me anymore. I don't mind them. I play them every now and then. But I'm a lot more into like those weird little niche indie games.
Yes.
I really enjoy them because they make me feel different things and think different things. And they're not written, from a power fantasy kind of viewpoint. So I tend to like them more because, I'm in that kind of weird stage in my life where I enjoy exploring strange and new things. And I find that role-playing games give me that opportunity much more than board games do. Board games are like, take all these mechanisms that you already know and pick a couple and put them together and see how they interact. And that can be new and fun and interesting. Don't get me wrong. I really like them and I make them. I must like them. However, I find that a lot of role-playing games make me like totally view the world in a new way. Like it like takes my thinking and turns it on the side and goes, that is so bizarrely interesting. So I do enjoy role playing a little bit more.
It's interesting because I've been playing role playing games since the very early 90s, and I have seen the evolution of role-playing games in all this time. And I've been playing board games for about 20 years now. because we didn't have that many board games away from Monopoly and, you know, Monster. That's the thing, is being at least where I grew up. And I've seen the evolution of board games. And although there are a number of board games that include a fair amount of emotional charge into them, but the evolution of board game has been really flat compared with the evolution of narrative and mechanisms and mechanics explorations in role-playing games. It's like people are more adventurous to design weird and new and different role-playing games.
Yes. Also, there's limitations. Like, there's constraints, right? So when you are dealing with boxes and cardboard and physical things, you have the limitations of what you can produce and put in a box. When you're dealing with the theater of the mind, as I call it, you're kind of limitless, right? The mind, the imagination is the limit. And that's kind of the thing. The other thing I like about role-playing games, which also makes them kind of easier to write in a way or create, is that most people are totally willing to house rule those. Whereas if you house rule a board game, you actually probably broke it. you might just break it, so it doesn't actually work quite right anymore. Whereas a role-playing game is really just suggestions. It's a toolbox of suggestions that you can use, and the world that you play in, and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I think there's a lot more potential for interesting play and it's different styles of play and what people define as play within a RPG system. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean they don't exist in board games. It means they're just harder to find, or it might be a game that you only can play once to get that exact same experience. Or, you know, you need a lot of people, or there's all these weird constraints that happen, especially because a lot of board games are not GM'd, right? There's nobody managing the game. Now, the ones that there are, they feel a little bit like RPGs, but they usually only are more like the combat end of RPGs, which is not my favorite part of RPGs, by the way. I would gladly play a non-combat RPG any day of the week.
Well, in fact, you designed one with Banana Chan recently.
Yeah. I mean, the whole idea was to not necessarily eliminate combat, but just to take the focus away from combat, because that wasn't really the story we wanted to have told. The story was about, you know, perseverance and resilience and that, which is not necessarily always like hand-to-hand combat. And we also, in that particular RPG, which is Jiangshi, we wanted to stray a little bit away from the commonly held trope that all Asian people know a martial art. Not necessarily true.
Tell me a little bit about the story. How did that game come about? Because, I mean, we spoke about it at length, and hopefully we'll do it again now. But as I mentioned before to you, it was a very audacious game to design and put out there. It was really very you, very, very Banana. You know, how did you come up with that game?
So Banana and I have been talking around each other for a long time, and, like, talking around, oh, we should work together, oh, we should work together. And then we had this idea, and it just became this game, where originally we had the idea, so there's a couple things that both Banana and I like. We both like artifacts, where you create a game where at the end of it, you have something that is, and you can keep it as a memory. We like games that are, culturally sound, which is interesting. We also like games that use weird, weird kind of randomizers. So this, I don't know if you can see these. Mm-hmm. This is what originated the idea for Jiangshi, because these are Chinese moon blocks, Taoist moon blocks, or Jiaobei, and they're used as a divination tool. You throw them in the air, and you intone your question, and the way they land, face up, face down, on their sides, dictates the answer. It's yes or no or maybe. So it's like a magic eight ball, but Chinese. Okay. And It's basically, we did that because we were jealous of Dread. We were envious of Dread. Oh, because the Jenga Tower as a mechanic is so phenomenal. right? And so we wanted to make something like that, like Epidaia did, but culturally appropriate for a story that we wanted to tell. And we got rid of them eventually because they're really expensive. And they also are kind of like an actual thing that people use. Mm-hmm. So it was a little bit maybe...
Yeah, it's a bit disrespectful at points.
Yeah. You know, it might be a little sensitive. So we changed it to D8s because 8 is a very lucky number in Chinese. And 4s are very unlucky. So we use the dice system where 4s cancel out your highest die value and all that kind of stuff. And you're looking for 8s as your successes. But... beyond that, the story was really something that came to us both in a lot of ways from the media, in a lot of ways from, you know, Trump being Trump, and the whole situation, the idea of the model minority and kind of thinking about how Asians are perceived in the West, because we're both Chinese and we're both living in Canada and the United States. And so we wanted to tell the story of immigration and how immigrants struggle, mm-hmm. Yet survive, and how the immigrant narrative or the immigrant experience is part and parcel of the Canadian and American fabric of society. And it wouldn't be the same if there weren't immigrants. And in the end, we decided on restaurants because that was a very common thing for Chinese people to work in because it was one of the only jobs they could actually have. Mm. Chinese people were pretty much stopped from working in certain fields. It could only come to Canada or America if they could show, you know, ownership in a company or something like that. And so restaurants were this really easy way because you need lots of staff and you need some expertise. And they would actually, people would immigrate and then learn how to cook and then go to work at a restaurant. There was like a whole system to kind of get around the very racist American and Canadian laws at the time, where they would actually prevent Chinese people from immigrating. Anyway, so the idea for us, though, was actually about the immigrant families living in a multi-generational household. Is a very big part of it because that's our experience in life, and about how sometimes you can't talk to your grandparents and your parents are stuck in between you and that kind of thing, how you have different hopes and dreams because of where you are from and where you're born, the culture shock that exists within a Chinese person born in Canada, United States versus their parents and grandparents who come from the old country. The most amazing part we found was that all of this resonated with anybody who's from an immigrant family or has, you know, those types of stories in their own household where food is a memory, where culture relates around the dining room table, where racism is a thing. So in our story of Zhangxi, the hopping vampires are an allegory or an analogy for racism. They are literally the oppression that happens. And again, like I was saying, this happened at a time when there's all the Trump stuff going on. And it was like super tiring. And that's exactly what Zhangxi do. They don't suck your blood and kill you. They drain your qi. They drain your energy. And slowly you turn into a Zhangxi because you have an imbalance in your life force, your vitality, whatever you want to call it. And so they were a stand-in. The vampires, the hopping vampires, were a stand-in for the oppression that people would feel due to overt and covert racism perpetrated against them in the time period which we chose, which was, you know, the 1920s in America and Canada. You can play before that, you can play after that, we don't really care. But that was a time we decided to write about because it was this interesting time where, you know, there were lots of Chinese people here. The gold rush had been over for a little while. What do we do with all these Chinese people? who we decided to negate a deal with because we were supposed to send them back to China, but we decided not to. And now we're stopping immigration, and some of them joined the war to prove themselves, but we still don't think of them as citizens. All this stuff was happening, right? So long story short, the idea of the multi-generational family running a restaurant and trying to keep that restaurant afloat in the face of racism and vampire attacks became kind of this set piece where saving the restaurant or cleaning the restaurant helps the family survive because it is literally like their anchor to this new world. And if they let the restaurant go to pot, they actually don't survive or they have to move or whatever, or they're driven out of the town. So there's a lot of mechanisms and plot points within the stories we wanted to tell through Junction that are sort of relevant to the immigrant tale that anybody who comes from a foreign country into Canada or United States would likely find, you know, somewhat similar to their own history. That's where that came from.
Long story short. Well, no, it is a really fascinating story because for you, your culture, where you're coming from, your identity is something that is pretty important, despite the fact that you are a Canadian citizen, that you were born in Canada, or Canadian, as I like to call it, but your ancestry still plays a massive role within your own identity. How come? Because for an awful lot of people there, it's a very, very difficult thing to understand because, you know, they've been white all their generations. They've been living here all their generations.
Well, yeah. And so even some people who are, you know, white, but they might claim, you know, Irish heritage or Scottish heritage or something like that. They can pass, right? And I can't. I can't change what I look like. I can't change my skin to a different color. And so even though my parents immigrated in the 70s, 60s and 70s, and I was born here, I'm still, and Banana still, we still deal with the racism that has been going on since like the 1800s, for like the last 100 years. And we're still dealing with the fallout of that 100 years later. And so it doesn't matter that I'm not one of the originals, you know, I'm not from the stock of the original settlers who came from, you know, Guangdong to British Columbia during the gold rush. That doesn't matter. The only fact that seems to matter to some people is that I look like I look. And so I wanted to explore, and Banana and I both wanted to explore what the history was. What made this happen? What are the laws that were enacted? Why do people think this way about Chinese people today still when they didn't, you know, why is it still this way? And how does this racism subtly change over generations? And I mean, the sad thing is that it doesn't change that much. The story is really an exploration of the life and times of all Chinese people, simply because we're treated as a monolith, right? Which is this interesting thing that most people do that. A lot of people will say, oh, you're this, therefore that, right? So prejudice, stereotyping, all those things happen because of outgrouping and all that kind of stuff. We were talking about psychological processes of othering. But we wanted to look at this specifically because it affected us. So that's where we started. But the neat thing is that, like I said, a lot of other people kind of hooked onto it and said, this is just like me and my grandmother. This is just like me and my family. And so in the adventure book, we have people writing from a Haitian perspective, people writing from a Latina perspective, people writing from a Romani perspective. So lots and lots of different interesting perspectives that are based around the core idea that maybe the big bad from your culture is representing racism. Mm. Because a lot of the big bads in most cultures, even, you know, traditional cultures, suck the life out of you, right? And that's kind of the idea that we have with racism. It is really tiring to do all the emotional labor that it takes to educate people on racism. And so we thought we'd do it in a game.
but the thing is that you need it in a game. And correct me if I'm wrong, but people really latched onto it. Now, I don't obviously know the demographics of the backers of the game, but did you know how many white people backed
that game? We don't know. Maybe we'll send out a survey that asks that. But it's I think from the names that I remember, I think there were definitely a high percentage of Chinese people and other Asian folk, but definitely, you know, a good amount of non-Asian people, which is fair, because it was written in English. That's part of it. And it's a role-playing game and people like games and it's got, you know, cool art. And so people are actually legitimately interested and that's good. I think there were quite a few people. I know lots of our biggest cheerleaders and fans were definitely not Chinese, not Asian. And it was really nice to see that people are interested, like genuinely interested in taking a look at the culture from a non-stereotypical perspective. And it's interesting because we do play into some tropes. Mm-hmm. And I talk to my students about this all the time. You know, stereotypes are there for a reason or are created for a reason. The only thing that's wrong is when we prejudge people or expect certain behaviors because of their race or culture, ethnicity or whatever, gender. Mm-hmm. And that's when it's wrong. To say that Chinese people own restaurants and say that's a stereotype would be wrong to say that it's a stereotype because it's actually true, mm-hmm. right? That is de facto the way that most people who have been in America and Canada for, you know, the last century, if you have Chinese heritage and your family has been here for the last 100 years, chances are along the way, your family ran, owned, or worked in a restaurant. Mm-hmm. It's the nature of the law, mm-hmm. right? The law created this situation where you were either working in laundry or you were working in a restaurant or some other non-masculine role.
That's quite an interesting thing because I compare that with at least what I can see of the Chinese immigration in Spain, mm-hmm. which, to be honest, we haven't had it for a huge length of time. And I remember when I was maybe 14, 13 years old, and we had the first Chinese restaurant opening in my town.
Right.
Because it was a really deep south kind of town. Funnily enough, it was run by a white fella who hired Chinese people to run the restaurant.
But, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was quite... I think it was somebody who came from a different city. I can't remember him at all. He was a businessman and thought, you know, I'm going to...
I'll run it. This will be a good business because there's nothing like it.
Exactly.
We'll hire people from China to come run it for authenticity and...
Correct.
You know, I'll make the money, they'll do the work. Perfect.
And that's it. Exactly. But now, you know, come forward another 30 years. And if you go around my city in Valencia, Mislata, pretty much anywhere in Spain, the only places where you will find, with exceptions, of course, but you will find people are either in Chinese restaurants, who most of them are owned by Chinese people. They buy an awful lot of bars and cafes, mm-hmm. and they run them. Or they have big stores with one of each, of anything you can imagine. I mean, there is a store, there are two of them literally in the corner of my street. And you have thousands of articles.
Yeah.
Incredibly expensive. And they are all over the place. And yet, for some reason, I really have no idea, because I haven't seen it. But I can only guess that there is some sort of racism in my country. You don't see them working pretty much anywhere else. And I have no idea why.
I mean, so it might be because that's the thing that they know. It also can be that there can be some immigration laws that you have to either have a job or run a business. Right? So oftentimes there are things like that where you have to prove, like, ties to the land that you will, you know, invest in Spain or wherever. So there's often things like that that keep immigrants in the jobs that they have, because then they do that job and then their family has to keep on doing their jobs, their kids have to keep doing that job and that kind of thing. So it's this kind of cyclical thing that happens. And then every now and then, you know, they have a lot of kids and one kid might go to, you know, university and that kid becomes, you know, the one in the family who doesn't work in the store or whatever, right? Because the same thing happened in so when my family escaped China during World War II, they went to Malaysia. And in Malaysia, both my mom's side and my dad's side both run stores with, you know, one of my grandfather had a store with a bar restaurant thing going on. So basically what you're saying. And they would all have, you know, lots of kids to help run the store and go do chores. And, you know, eventually some kids stayed and some kids, you know, the ones that didn't stay would go to university or school. But it's not everybody that got to go to school. So it's this really interesting kind of cyclical thing, right? Where it's like a family business. It is a family business where, you know, you want to keep it in the family. Therefore, you know, somebody's got to learn how to run the shop. And their kids get to learn how to run the shop, or some of their kids get to learn how to run the shop, and it continues and continues and continues. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just a different way of life, right? And I think it's that's where in Jiangxi that comes up in Hopes and Dreams, which is a big part of the game for me personally, because it really does kind of tear at the cultural differences that exists between the individualization of the Western cultures and a more family-oriented culture where, you know, you're expected to make sacrifices for your family. Mm-hmm. And you are in Western culture as well, but not as much, right? It's not the same. And in, you know, Chinese cultures, you're expected to forego your own desires for the betterment of the family as a whole, you know, like arranged marriages and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's just this interesting kind of viewpoint of the world through the eyes of restaurateurs. And so that's really why we picked it, is because it's a really easy hook for people to know. Most people have eaten in a Chinese restaurant, mm-hmm. right? Especially in North America. And they understand that, now most people understand that Chinese food that they get served in a Chinese restaurant in Canada or America is not authentic, mm-hmm. unless they go to an authentic restaurant. And so there's all this kind of mishmash of interesting stuff that happens because of immigration. And it's a really interesting and almost wonderful thing that it's just interesting when people are so anti-immigration that it just boggles my mind, to be honest.
I personally don't get it at all. So it's a bit, it's just bizarre. How did Banana and you work together? I mean, how did you share your tasks? Because I get the feeling that this has been a pretty close to the bone game to design for both of you. You seem to have gone very deep into what was going on. How are we going to translate this experience into a playable format? How did you work together?
Google, Google Docs, technologically Google Docs, and a whole lot of Zoom calls and Facebook messaging and stuff. really, it's really just me calling Banana like at weird hours and saying, hey, I got an idea. I just listened to this podcast. We should do this. And it keeps on going like that until we both agree that we should do it. And so it's this like nice interplay of ideas. And Banana being a great role player and LARPer, she's always yes anding, right? So she's like, oh, yes, and we can do that. And so we end up with this whole list. I have a list of all our silly ideas. And some of them are actually really good. And some of them have become total games that were, that'll be, you'll see in 2021 or 2022, depending on when the publishing cycle is. But the ideas come out and then we refine them. And the ones that kind of stick out are the ones that we keep on going with. So it's basically like, are we both interested in this? Then we'll start it. Are we still both interested in it? Then we'll keep on going. And sometimes one or two of them kind of pop up to the top. Like we're really inspired to work on that. And so some of the other ones just percolate at the bottom, and that's fine because a lot of the ones that percolate at the bottom may not have been ready. Mm-hmm. They were just kind of nascent ideas that needed a little bit more incubation time. And so now that we're done Junction pretty much, we've looked at the list and go, oh, now we know what to do with this one, or now I know what to do with that one. So the process is a lot like that for the beginning. And then we just go off and write and write and write and write. Banana, being a publisher herself, is a lot more attuned to that. And she has a lot more ties within the US RPG community, especially amongst people of color. And so she leverages that and brings those people to the table to help write. And then I'm more of the systems person, so I'm more design the mechanisms and kind of fiddle with those a lot, which is why you'll see a lot of our role-playing games that we write together have some more board gamey elements to them, because I believe that there's, you know, this hybridization that is a good thing, that makes things a little more memorable or accountable, especially in short-form games where we don't have this long-running narrative. How do you keep account of that? But the long narratives are hard to keep account of as well, but I like working in short forms. And then Banana took care of a lot of the publishing stuff, liaisoning with Wet Ink Games, our co-publisher, the manufacturers, and all that kind of stuff, and media. She's really on the ball when it comes to scheduling, you know, media and interviews and videos and actual plays and all that kind of stuff, because she's very tied into that community. I'm not so much, I'm more in the board gaming world. And so that was super helpful and got to meet lots of new people and play games with them. It was super fun. So yeah, I think, you know, we both do a heck load of work when it comes to it. And it's just that Banana's much more on the publishing side and I'm much more on the writing side. Not that she doesn't write and that I don't help her on the publishing side. She definitely writes, but it's more of a, like the balance is, her area of expertise lends her to working in the publishing side as well. I guess that's the better way to put it.
How cathartic was it for you to work on this game, if at all?
Oh, I mean, super cathartic. It was really cathartic because when you write about stuff that is close to you and you get to express it, and you get people saying, I get it. Mm-hmm. You know, you feel validated. You feel seen. You feel like people are understanding your experience. And literally, that's all kind of, I think anybody wants, right? When we talk about things like acknowledging people's pronouns and, you know, things like that, or, you know, when people say, I don't see color, why that's problematic. And it's problematic because, you know, we need to recognize that people have different experiences than we do. And it doesn't mean we coddle them because of it. It doesn't mean we necessarily celebrate because of that. It means that we recognize it. And that's kind of all anybody really wants. Like, you know, when somebody's talking about, you know, gay pride parade, why do they have a gay pride parade? Why don't we have a heterosexual pride parade? It's like, well, I mean, really, think about it. Think about it for a second. And also, you know, people just want to be recognized as being human. Mm-hmm. Literally, that's it, right? You know, and in the stories that we're telling, it's really about, we want people to recognize the hardships that were that our ancestors went through, but not pity. It's not about pity. It's never really about pity. And it's not really about, you know, anybody necessarily changing history. Mm-hmm. It's about, so what are you going to do about that now? How are you going to change your life now? Because now you know, right? Now you know something a little bit about how things happened. Now what? And if you say, well, nothing, it's like, okay, that's fine. I would hope most people would say, oh, I'm going to change my life in a positive way because of what I just learned or experienced. And the idea that representation matters is really, really important to me because, well, I think representation matters for lots of reasons. And the whole idea of being seen and heard and felt really just reaffirms that a person has worth. And when you go back in history and you think about any marginalized group, they have literally been made to feel like they're worthless. Mm-hmm. You know, they have been made to feel like they are subhuman. They have been made to feel like they are not equal in many ways, whatever that way is, whether it's, you know, not being allowed to marry because you're gay, or not being allowed to marry because you're Chinese and the person that you love is not Chinese. That was, like, it's not an oppression Olympics. Like, we're not playing oppression Olympics. We're not saying, oh, those people are more oppression than these people. We're saying oppression sucks in general. It really does. And that if you take a moment to understand how this happened, maybe we can make it not happen again. Or maybe you can understand why people are angry. Or maybe you can understand why people have to have things like a gay pride parade, right? You know, I grew up in the 70s and the 80s when it was literally, you know, AIDS was the thing, was the biggest thing of my childhood. And, you know, the rallying cries over here, we're queer and we're not going to leave, you know, that echoes in my head as, you know, a rallying point for a community that had really just had enough of being treated like subhuman. And then, you know, and it hasn't changed. It's changed, but sometimes it hasn't. Like, you get, you know, states that still haven't, in the most progressive country in the world, you know, the most advanced country in the world, that still don't allow same-sex marriages. And it's like, well, why not? Who does it hurt? Exactly. What does it hurt? Well, unless you are saying that America is a white Catholic state, a Christian state, sorry. And if you're saying that, then we've got some problems, because that's clearly not what America should be, because it's supposed to be a separation of state and church. So we need to think about that and talk about that a little bit more. Anyway, I really do think that writing allows, like, writing an RPG allows me to talk about this stuff much easier than a board game does. Board games, for some reason, are seen as entertainment, which is fine, and that's good. But they're very rarely seen as a form of deeper introspection. Sometimes they're seen as education, and usually when they're seen as education, they're thought of as, oh, that must suck. If it's educational, it must not be a good game. But we've seen some board games that have kind of broken the mold. So things like Holding On, which is really interesting.
Yes.
And a lot of people are starting to make board games that are a little bit deeper and a little bit more interesting, and not always happy, and not always, you know, combat, not always that kind of thing. It's so, I think we're getting into a place where there will be more games that are a little bit more like that. I think the problem happens in that games, like board games, are seen much more as a product and a commodity because they're in a box. I don't know. It might just be the form factor.
I think it's also a matter of tradition. You know, board games have been around for a lot longer than role-playing games.
And oh, yeah. So
they've had, I know this is going to sound very weird, but they've had better reputation than role-playing games. You know, I don't think board games have had the reputation for nastiness that role-playing games have had.
You're right. So, I mean, most people don't know what role-playing games are. Mm. And if they do, a lot of people, Dungeons and Dragons. And if you're from my time, it'd be like, Satanic Panic.
Exactly, it's Gecko's.
Yeah, or very subversive. And I think that's okay. I think, like, role-playing games to me are like the punk rock of like the music scene, right?
Okay.
They're like subversive and kind of out there, and a lot of DIY mentality, and a lot of, whatever it takes. Whereas board games maybe are more like pop, mm-hmm. where they're prepackaged and they look kind of similar and they use similar mechanics, and they're not, treading too deep into the deep waters. So it's interesting. I actually have a theory about this. Sen's theory of innovation in board games. And it goes a little something like this, is that people say they want innovation, but they really don't. They want comfort plus. So they want what they had before with a little twist. That's what they want. Because you'll find that any really innovative game actually doesn't sell. And those games that are just like not a revolution, but an evolution, like an evolution of a game that was just popular, mm-hmm. that's what sells. So you'll see, like, Clank is a great example of a deck builder based on like a Dominion style, but added the board and added some, characterization, and now it's added legacy, right? So it's just, and it didn't go from Clank, from Dominion to Clank Legacy. It went from Dominion to Clank to another version of Clank, and now Clank Legacy, right? So you'll see that. I mean, even Machikoro went from, which is basically Dominion plus Settlers of Catan smashed together. It's like Dominion, Settlers of Catan. Okay, Machikoro. Okay, now a couple of expansions of Machikoro. Okay, now Machikoro Legacy, right? So it's these subtle advancements of the mechanisms, mm-hmm. and addition of different mechanisms that's what people want, or at least buy.
Okay.
Right, because if it's too innovative, it's almost too hard to understand,
uh-huh.
or it takes too long to learn, which is another thing that's very different about role-playing games versus RPGs. So a lot of RPGs, as a player, you don't need to know almost anything. You don't have to,
mm-hmm.
right? You don't have to voraciously read the player's manual in order to play Dungeons and Dragons. You don't. I mean, if you want to min-max, sure. But yeah, you can seriously just play and it'd be fun.
Yeah.
And the only person who does is a dungeon master. Whereas in a board game, everybody should know the rules, mm-hmm. because you're actually trying to win.
Yes.
Right? Which is another very big difference, obviously, in role-playing games. So I think there's innovation is something that we say we like, and designers love innovation, but publishers are like, it's a little too much. And if a publisher thinks it's too much, it's definitely too much for the buying public.
Definitely.
The buying public is slower than the publishers, is slower than the designers, right? And then on the flip side of things, that's why I find RPGs invigorating, because mm-hmm. they throw out some of the weirdest stuff ever and it seems to work and it's interesting. But there's still, there's still people who play OSR, and there's still people who are very much like Fate or Powered by the Apocalypse, and I only like those style of games, and that's cool. Because they provide good frameworks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They have that, and that's it. Let's go over to Joshua for a minute, because I would like to ask you, being a very experience-specific game that happened, that's meant to be framed around the Chinese experience, do you think, or have you being concerned that it could be used to actually misinterpret and mistreat those stereotypes and basically be used for racism purposes?
Sure. And we've had some people push back. One of my friends actually thinks that if you are playing a Chinese person and you're not Chinese, that could be construed as racist, or not racist, but fueling possible racism, right? Mm-hmm. Because they don't have any experience to go back on, so they'll just false tropes. And I would say true, unless you provide the tools, right? And so we provide a lot of tools in terms of how to play a character that is Chinese, how to, you know, role play that, how to game master that. And so we provided all those tools. At the end of the day, you know, like any other role playing system, those are just guidelines, right? They're just, again, tools that are in a toolbox and you can take them or leave them. We definitely had pushback during the campaign from other people from different parts of the world who are Chinese and said, you know, I don't know if this is going to support you know, just help people live out racist fantasies. And the notion there, though, is that all the characters in the game as player characters are going to be Chinese in some way, shape, or form. So if all the characters are Chinese, the at least they're not hopefully being super racist toward each other, though internalized racism is a thing, lateral violence is a thing. Mm-hmm. But the ideas of the GM learning how to play racism without depicting racism is actually really, really something that we put a lot of time and effort into. Where it's like, okay, you can explain what happens. You don't have to say the actual words, mm-hmm. right? You can say, they say something that's racist towards you that has something to do with this. And you don't have to say the words. You just know that that happened, right? And I know that, you know, just like I said before, that, you know, the whole diaspora experience is not, we're not monolithic by any means. So people who immigrated to, say, Indonesia or Malaysia are very different than people who immigrated to North America, who are very different than people who immigrated to Britain or whatever. And those are different experiences, and they should be different, and they should be considered in a different way or different light. So people may need to modify their world in Jiangshi if they're playing in a different country, because we just described North America because that's what we know. I think there definitely is risk inherent in it. But I would hope that the pros greatly outweigh the cons, because trust me, those people who are being racist are going to be racist no matter what you do.
Very true.
And I'm hoping that the people who we do, you know, show a little bit of the reasons and the wherewithal behind the story, that they, you know, get it, and they may reduce some of the ways that they have been racist in the past. You know, we're all a little bit racist, as the song goes from Avenue Q. No matter if you think you are or not, you probably are, and you probably have some pre-existing biases, because that's all racism really is. The question is, do you act on them, right? You know, there is a school of thought that would say racism is prejudice and power. We can go there if you'd like, but that's not really, that's not necessarily the way most people think about racism. So I guess in a game that portrays racism, you're going to get racism. Mm-hmm. The question is, how do you portray it in a way that's not harmful? How do you learn from that? I think is more important than the actual act itself of racism. What are you going to do about that tomorrow? What are you going to do in your life about that? Is where the game can be transformative, right? And how do you use it to understand other people where there is, you know, empathy? Now, there's definitely people who don't believe that putting yourself in another person's shoes can create strong empathy. I am not one of those people, mm-hmm. because I actually do believe that. So there's definitely battles to be fought about this, and words to be had about them. But I think in the end of the day, it's just like, analysis paralysis. So a lot of people say, well, or quarterbacking in a co-op game, a lot of people say, oh, this game causes analysis paralysis, or this game has a lot of quarterbacking. And it's like, no, it's not the game. It's the people who you're playing with. They're just douches, so don't play with them. Now, you could say the game, sets up an environment where this could happen. You can say that. And yes, it could. but so could any game. Mm-hmm. Right. And like I said, again, if that person is racist, they're going to be racist. And I think the good thing about this type of thing in a game that creates a sacred space, a sacred circle to play in, not only does it give people the, you know, ability to be racist, which is not great, it also gives you an ability to call them out on it within the form of the game, right? Which is a little maybe safer. Mm-hmm. So you could say, you know, your character could say, well, my character walks up to your other character and says, what do you mean by that joke? And now you're not confronting that person, mm-hmm. right? So you can do things in the role playing that you could do in real life as well. And it might create a safer space for you to do that if you are willing to confront racism. I guess the other point would be that it's the type of game that maybe don't play with people you don't know. Like, it's not the kind of thing that would be a COD pickup game necessarily, unless you were playing with a group of people who were all friends and there was a COD GM. That might be okay. But it's not the game. It's not the style of game I would recommend for that anyway, but who knows? There might be.
Well, let's hope you get loads of feedback about that and see where...
Yeah, well, where I mean, we'll see, right?
Great to see playing, absolutely. Okay, to wrap up this podcast, I know this is a very, very cheesy question to ask.
Sure.
But if you had to explain somebody, especially white people, why they should try Zhenxue, what would you tell them?
I would ask them if they like to learn things. Do you like to learn stuff? Because you'll learn stuff. And you'll have fun doing it, right? So I hope that, you know, our writing isn't so heavy-handed that people go, oh, you're trying to push an agenda on us. I mean, there definitely is. There definitely is an agenda, which is don't treat people different, bad just because they look different. And difference isn't a bad thing, right? That we should celebrate those differences.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Differences aren't a bad thing. We're not trying to homogenize everybody. And in the, you know, why should people play this game? I think it's because you will learn something about other people and yourself at the same time by being part of a story that hopefully resonates with more than just Chinese people. It just happens to be in the trappings of Chinese people because we're writing from our hearts. We're writing from our experiences and our families and our familiar surroundings and trappings. So I think that's what I would say to people. You should play this. Yes. And you'll learn something.
Well, let's indeed hope that they do. Sam, thank you so much. Normally, I would have the three abstract questions, and I would normally be able to come up with some, but it's already midnight, and my brain is doing something very funny already. So I will have to have you around at some point so I can ask you three different questions. So
sure.
Hopefully for some expansions or something that you do very soon indeed. But in the meantime, I really hope that Zhenxue does really, really well, and I can get my hands on a copy as soon as possible, so I can have a go at it. That would be when it gets to the stores. So, congratulations on the success! Thank you so much.
Cool. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Paco.
If you have enjoyed that anywhere near as much as I have, you should be a lot happier now. Seriously, that was absolutely fantastic, and I cannot wait to talk to Zhang a lot further, because the work that they are doing, not just with Zhenxue and Banana Chang, but with so many other people, is fantastic, absolutely fantastic. I could keep going. I'm not going to. I'm just going to say to you all, thank you very much indeed for being there. I really hope that you've enjoyed this. And I will come back very soon with more interviews and more reviews and a lot more content. But until the next time, by all means, do leave me your comments. Do leave me a review in iTunes if you're listening to this podcast, please, because that helps a lot. And I will be talking to you very, very soon. Take care.